This is the Husker Doc Talk Podcast, presented by the Remington Trophy, 2020, Episode 15. I promise I will not gloat that much during this podcast. I'm Travis Justice, the guy you hear laughing on the other end. Well, that's the one, the only Dr. Rob Zadiska. Black Friday has come and gone. Iowa 26 and Nebraska 20. Dr. Rob, your first impressions of Nebraska's yet another loss on the season?
Boy, I tell you what, that was, you know, it was funny because a lot of the kind of the social media commentary I saw after the game, you saw a lot of people who came off with the idea that, hey, man, after that Illinois loss, I was super concerned. There is some deep-seated problems within the program. I'm really worried about the direction of things. And then I kind of saw a little bit of a turnaround with that after the Iowa game, where people were like, oh, you know what, the fire's back. We're so close. We're almost there. I'm almost more concerned after the Iowa game, to be honest with you.
Really?
I mean, I felt the opposite.
Why is that?
Well, because it's, I mean, all of a sudden, I feel like we're sounding like a broken record here with some of the issues at play. And it's, again, it's a lot of these little things like discipline, the penalties, the turnovers. Those are things that just have kind of continually plagued this program for 3 years. Special teams play, being able to cover kicks, fielding punts. I mean, and I get it. Sometimes this time of year especially, sun's at kind of a bad angle. You're staring right into it, trying to find the ball on a punt return, trying to catch that ball rather on a punt return. And it's I get it, but still, these are things that 3 years into a well-coached, well-disciplined program you would not expect to be seen, and yet we're still seeing them, and they're game changers. These are things that are killing Nebraska right now.
You know, it's interesting because I was just watching the Scott Frost news conference after the game, and again, he talked about the same thing, you know, the mental mistakes driving him nuts. But he went back and he said, you know, I don't like to talk about what was here before I got here, but it wasn't very disciplined. Come on, man. We're 3 years into this thing, right? And how can you continue to use that as an excuse? You can't.
And that's the thing. Now, I could still make the point that maybe there's just an atrocious level of talent within the program, and they're still working past that to a degree. And I get that. I've always kind of really fully bought into that notion. I'm just also of the mindset that, okay, you know what, I get it, but that means we're maybe not a 10 or 11 win type team yet. That lack of talent means we're going to still knock out 5 to 7 wins a season, and then in year 4, year 5, we're going to make that jump to 9, 10, 11 wins. That was kind of the mindset I had, this where we're still in a state of, you know, we slip past a team like Penn State that definitely has some issues this season, but otherwise we're absolutely struggling to win games against teams that Nebraska probably has the talent to beat. And when I say that, I'm talking about Iowa. I don't mean Iowa's a bad program, but I think we've got enough talent to go toe-to-toe with those guys. And that's why you kind of saw Nebraska go toe-to-toe with Iowa. It's these other things that I find hugely concerning that haven't been cleaned up after 3 years. Year one, I get it. There's going to be some lack of discipline. Penalties and turnovers are going to be a problem. You're going to try and you're kind of trying to figure out a way to motivate guys to go out there and be superstars on special teams. Those are the things you expect to see in year one, not in year three. Those are fixable problems, and we haven't fixed them 3 years in. Talent, I get. You're going to see a change in talent, and I still like, not all, but parts of the direction that Nebraska is going from a talent standpoint. What I don't like is these, what I perceive to be fixable problems that just aren't being fixed, and that, and I don't have a good answer as to why they're not, and I don't know if anybody does.
Wouldn't you say mental aspect of it and these problems takes place during the week? I mean, that's all practice, right? It's all the way you're prepared.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, well, you know, I kind of come from the Tom Osborne school where 95% of the game happens during the week. You winning or losing rarely happens on Saturday. It's those 4, 5, 6 days previous to the game that make that determination of whether you're going to win or lose. And I still think that's a very real concept in today's athletics. If you don't have good preparation, if you don't have that discipline during the week, that's where it shows up, is on Saturday. And that's what we're seeing right now. And so I really have trouble believing that these are things that are being worked on in practice, which then, I mean, it kind of leads me into sort of a corollary line of thinking of, well, is the stuff they're working on in practice, or some of these offensive and defensive systems that they're trying to employ, so complex that you've got this quarterback guru coach in Mario who's sitting there wearing funky glasses, chomping on a cigar and talking about his wife's cooking, that he's got such a complex scheme for these guys. They don't have time to work on everything from snapping the ball to reducing penalties.
And that's
concerning to me.
You know what's funny is, who does that sound like, right? Because it almost sounds like Bill Callahan, right? Where he had this playbook that was just so thick and he was so cerebral. And really, it's a pretty simple game we're talking about.
Well, and there's been other coaches we've seen like that. I mean, I think a guy like – because I truly think a guy like Bob Diaco on paper – is an absolute defensive genius. And I say that in all seriousness. I know there's a lot of people chuckling at me, but the analogy that I've used time and again, it's kind of like you're trying to, it's like you've got Einstein trying to teach the theory of relativity to third graders. They just aren't going to get it. And there's limits to how much you're going to be able to pack into these kids' heads. And I think at some point you got to have some basics within the structure of your program in order to have things, you know, consistently function at a high level. It's not like Tom Osborne's offense was incredibly simple. I mean, it wasn't. He had what I would call a pretty kind of a medium to medium high level of complexity within his offense. But that playbook wasn't so thick that you couldn't learn it. I mean, you did learn it. It wasn't that hard. It was complex enough to keep the defense on their toes, but probably the higher, kind of the main aspect of it was that Osborne demanded this near perfection level of execution. We practiced the same concepts constantly. And so by the time you got into a game, running the offense, running the plays, making the calls along the line of scrimmage became secondhand. I mean, the execution became a higher level of importance than memorizing this massive playbook.
You know, you bring up the Tom Osborne era, you know, the former players now who embraced Scott when he was hired are now starting to maybe turn their back on him a little bit. The grumblings from former players are getting louder and louder and louder. Does that surprise you?
Oh, maybe, you know, there's maybe a little bit, not a lot. I mean, we want to see that high level. And I think one of the things that's disappointing is, and I understand, there's got to be, you've got to be your own coach. You got to do your own thing. You can't have the same system. But there's kind of some really core basics that work, that tend to work very well within football that are kind of tried and true. I mean, you see a lot of stuff that pops in over the years that people play around with for a while, and then people kind of figure it out and you move on from it. And I guess I'm talking about things that seem kind of antiquated now, but I mean, it's hard to beat as long as you execute it well and you've got at least a medium level of talent. A reasonable pro-style offense with a strong running game is kind of hard to beat in football. You're going to consistently do fairly well. And when you look around the landscape of college football, those are the teams that consistently do fairly well with that. I mean, Penn State for years did very little more than have a basic pro-style passing offense with a strong running game. Schembechler's Michigan teams, pro style passing offense with a strong running game. You start to see little variations on that, but I mean, if you look at what some of these coaches like Nick Saban at Alabama, pro style passing offense with a strong running game, what you saw from LSU with Joe Burrow at quarterback, pro-style passing offense with a strong running game. I mean, it's just, there's nothing crazy here in terms of how they do this.
You're leaving out one team. That would be Iowa, who did the exact same thing against Nebraska. And you and I talked about this. I said, the one thing I was happy with what Kirk Ferentz, coming from an Iowa fan's perspective, was Kirk Ferentz, I thought for sure when Nebraska did a good job of stopping Iowa's run early in the first and second quarters. Iowa kept with the running game, which was a pleasant surprise because against Northwestern, he abandoned it and it cost him in the end. Yesterday, or on Friday rather, he stuck with it. And you saw that. It wasn't a great running performance. He only averaged less than 3 yards a carry. But in the second half, it really went from 1 to 2 yards a carry to 4 to 5 yards a carry, and that made a difference.
It was effective. I mean, yeah, that average was less than 3, but when you look at it,
yep,
it was like you hit the nail on the head. That was like a 1.5 yards per carry in the first half, and it was 5 in the second. And, I mean, that running game wore him down. I mean, it's – Nebraska's defense was getting gassed there in the second half. But yeah, Iowa does a great job with that. Northwestern, they're kind of in that same boat. When you look at Penn State's productivity in the second half against Nebraska was they had a high level of productivity against Nebraska in the second half. And again, it was very basic. I mean, it was kind of some short mid-range pro-style passing offense coupled with a really strong running game, and they moved the ball against Nebraska. I mean, I would, you know what, it's not super far-fetched for me to say Nebraska is a little lucky against Penn State. I mean, we had some big plays on defense where it really bailed that team out for the most part in the second half on those red zone drives by Penn State. Otherwise, Nebraska's sitting here with a big goose egg in the win column.
Yeah, that would be interesting if that would have happened. Now, but they're also so close to winning games. They were close against Northwestern. To be honest, they were close against Iowa. But as you mentioned, the mental mistakes, turnovers, and penalties proved to be costly.
Well, you take the five freaking turnovers away against Illinois. And maybe that's a completely different ball game.
True.
I mean, that's, you know, it's the turnovers for this team are massively detrimental. I mean, I throw this out there and I use this example a lot. But if you look at the kickoff classic that Nebraska played in 94 against not a great, but a pretty solid, it was a West Virginia team. It was a bowl game team that year. But you had a solid West Virginia team. Nebraska had 5 turnovers that day and won 31-0. But that's literally one of the top 5 Nebraska teams of all time. The current Nebraska team is not one of the top 5 Nebraska teams of all time. It's so one turnover can make a world of difference for a team like that. You have five turnovers against Illinois. That's the difference between winning a game and losing that game. You give us those five turnovers back, and all of a sudden that Illinois ball game becomes a completely different that's a whole nother scenario, and I think Nebraska walks out of it, shockingly, I say this, with a win. So it's, I mean, that's why I'm concerned after this Iowa game, because they cleaned up the effort. They cleaned up the lack of fire. I mean, they came out ready to, I mean, they were sitting there for four quarters. Nebraska lined up, and from a, I guess I'd call it the emotional standpoint of football, they stood in there and traded punches for four quarters with Iowa. But they still lost because of those same things that haven't been fixed in 3 years. The turnovers, penalties, and special teams play.
Well, of course, and that's becoming an excuse. And here was another excuse. Pause for me here, but I have to take time to laugh at this a little bit. And I also have to say, call bullshit on it as well.
Clap on. There was clapping going on their sideline. Clap
on. So, I mean, what the hell are we talking about?
Clap on. We discussed with officials and didn't happen in the second half. Clap
on. It's football, so maybe they need to change their cadence if it was interfering with the cadence. I don't know. I've never heard of that.
Clap on. Clap off. Clap on. Clap off.
The clapper.
Clapgate 2020, my friend.
I started laughing because as soon as you said it, I'm like, "Ep, we're cutting to Kirk Ferentz here."
Because let's be, and you and I had a long conversation about this yesterday. What Scott did there was A, make an excuse, then stoke the fire with a certain members of the fan base who are like, "Yeah, yeah, I was cheating. It wouldn't have happened." A couple things here. Even if they were clapping, I know you can see the video, that was more of a, come on, guys, let's go. I'm going to take the Iowa side here. But when you still hike the ball, clapping's not going to put it in a guy's shins, and clapping's not going to put it over a guy's head. And you also brought up another fact, and you actually kind of agreed with me here. I'm selling you out, that you used an example of your own son, Ryan, who's at the state, you know, wrestling tournament. When there's whistles all over the place, go to a volleyball tournament, there's whistles all over the place. You got to know where your whistle's coming from or your clap's coming from, and you better know a clap from 5 yards away as opposed to 50 yards away.
It is, and it's, you know, that's something that I guess I would chalk up as, hey, that's just kind of part of sports in general. There's going to be those distractions. And while I don't – see, I look at the video and I'm like, dude, that guy, he was thinking, I'm going to try and sneak one in here and see if I can't force a bad snap, which actually on the play that video comes from, I don't even think it was the play that had the bad
snap. Wasn't. It wasn't.
I know. That's the thing. I'm looking at that video and I'm going, okay, that guy actually is trying to cause it and didn't, but which that only reinforces the point I think both of us are trying to make, is that something like that, even if it does affect things, it doesn't negate the fact that it shouldn't affect things. Now, either A, like you said, figure out where it's coming from, or B, switch to a verbal cadence like 90% of the population. I mean, it drives me nuts that they went to this clap cadence, and I see a lot of people using it. So, I mean, it's not, I say 90%. There's a number of teams that use it. There's a number of teams that like it. I can't stand it because there's no lead in to it. And I don't understand. I just don't see how that it provides that much more benefit. If it's a case of, hey, we can hear a clap better, I guess I kind of get that. But on the flip side also, I've played in, and I think I mentioned this to you yesterday, I've played in four bowl games in Florida against Florida teams, and somehow we figured out how to mitigate the noise without moving to a clap.
All right, so
I just don't think it's a good idea.
So take me through your cadence. So we've got the clap here, which they say can be heard better in a loud stadium. I don't know how that's possible, but maybe because you're 5 yards away. I get that. That's why a coach clapping from 50 yards away, or even sitting in the middle of the field 25 yards away, doesn't make much sense. Plus, it's not coming at you from directly behind you. It's coming from the side of you. But, again, we could have a long conversation about this. But I want to know, how did you guys do the cadence and the snap count when you knew you were playing in Florida, let's say for a bowl game under hostile conditions? What worked for you guys in a loud stadium?
Honestly, you just had to pay better attention. And sometimes it was a case of where you just had to go kind of like the defense. You went on the ball snap. When that ball moved, you went. And we would do some things as well, too, both in college and at the NFL level, where, not to sound goofy about it, but, I mean, the guard and tackle would hold hands. And the guard would literally jerk their hand away at the snap, and that's how you knew as a tackle that the ball had been snapped. Now, again, it doesn't give you as much advantage over the defense, and that's, but you know what, at a high level of football, I get seconds count, milliseconds count, but it still usually leaves you in a functional level of operation. Now, the other thing is, too, is most of the time, you even in a really, really loud stadium, you could usually still hear something. And that's where I actually like the verbal snap count, is because you could kind of hear that kind of lead into the actual snap count. And now you asked me what we used at Nebraska. We used, they would repeat, the quarterback would repeat two sets of numbers, say like 21-12, 21-12, and then whatever number of huts the snap count was on, 1, 2, or 3 usually. And so hearing, like having it loud enough that you don't hear a single portion of the cadence I get. I mean, if you come up to the line and, hey, we're going on a quick count, I'm going to come up and just say hut. That's hard to hear. If you're coming up there and there's kind of this 3 or 4 second cadence, you can usually pick that up at some point, even if it's really, really loud out in the stadium. And so that usually made it work okay for us. So the other thing that was helpful with it is that with the clap cadence, when the quarterback audibles, it's blazingly obvious it's an audible. Now, I understand if you've got to move some people around and reposition guys, you know it's probably an audible. But when we had the verbal cadence, the way it worked was, I'd mentioned there's two sets of numbers that were repeated. The way it worked is that if the first number corresponded to the play that was called, and we used a number system for all our plays.
So give me an example.
Like a 44 would be an ISO play, isolation play. 44 and 46 were our isolation plays. So if a quarterback comes up to the line and say, oh, and then, for instance, say 41 would be, is a pitch play. And so if the quarterback comes up to the line and let's say he calls 44 ISO in the huddle, comes up to the line, doesn't like the look of the ISO and thinks the pitch would be better, the first number in that two sets of numbers, if it's the play that was called, that means you're audibling to whatever the second number is. So if he calls 44 ISO in the huddle, you come up to the line of scrimmage and all of a sudden you hear Behringer or Frazier going 44-41, 44-41. Right then and there, you know, oh my gosh, we just audibled from a 44 ISO to a 41 pitch. We're running 41 pitch now. So that was how we audibled. And so there wasn't this kind of verbal breakaway from the clap to signal to everybody that it's an audible. It's he'd come up to the line and just, we're audibling right here. And you never saw hardly any movement. Now, occasionally guys would go in motion or have to reposition. But you've got guys going in motion and reposition, but you don't have this big, glaringly obvious signal to the defense, hey, everybody, we're audibling. Because the defense knows tendencies. The offense knows tendencies. And if the defense shows up in one look, sees very obviously that it's an audible, sometimes from those tendencies, you know what play's coming. And so if you don't know that it's an audible, that's just an additional advantage. You can't do that with the clap cadence, though. If there's an audible, it's going to be pretty damn obvious. I mean, you can tell on TV it's an audible. So
yeah, because
it's just something else I don't like about it.
So what you're saying is you could actually, when on your way, and I'm sure you can do it some way with a clap, but if Frazier or Brooke would have said 44, it stayed the same. Say it was still a 44 ISO instead of a 41 pitch, right? And so you could.
Yeah. I mean, if they wanted the play to stay the same, they go with a set of numbers that were complete. It would be completely random. So
okay. They
come up there and go, if they call a 44 ISO in the huddle and they decide they stick with it, the quarterback's going to yell out like 12, 21, 12, 21, hut, hut, hut. And there you go. So you had this system that allowed you to audible without making it insanely obvious to the defense that you were audibling. Nine times out of ten, they wouldn't know at all. So.
Do you think the clapping, and again, I know Nebraska fans are going to blame Kirk Ferentz, that's fine, but I'm going to go somewhere else, and I haven't heard anything of this, and Scott Frost won't say it because he doesn't think it was a problem, except for the Iowa sideline. You can tell I'm going to beat a dead horse into the ground. But anyway, could it be a different clapping style between Martinez and McCaffrey?
Possibly. And I'd be the first to tell you also, different verbal cadences kind of screwed you up a little bit. I mean, you had a different quarterback come in. You got really used to whoever the starting quarterback's cadence came in. And all of a sudden, if you're in a game and you've been playing and Frazier's been in there, now Brooke comes in or Brooke's in, and then, you know what, Matt Turman comes in to relieve him at the end of the game. Yeah, you kind of got to be on your toes and pay attention because that snap count's different. And there's a lot of times you're back in the huddle and somebody like Aaron Graham or Stye's telling the quarterback, hey, you need to slow that snap count down. Or, hey, when you're on the number portion of that, you need to enunciate that better. I mean, different quarterbacks do have a different style. And so, yes, that can screw stuff up also. And maybe that was the problem on Saturday. I don't know for sure, but that might have been the issue with the clapping. Although, to my understanding, there was really only one play where it looked like that ball got snapped prior to the actual clap. And again, you hit the nail on the head too. If the snap hits Martinez right in the chest, That's one thing. If the snap's like 8 inches off the ground, that's another. And even though it was early, it was much worsened by the fact the ball hit him in the lower, basically hit him at the ankles.
Well, let's talk about Cam Jurgens, because Scott Frost says there wasn't a problem with Cam, but I would disagree as to where those snaps were. And I was kind of watching you on Twitter, and you've had some conversations, I believe, with your brother just about the center position. Geez, if they would just recruit a center, right?
And that's, you know, and I think it more than anything, I mean, I made the point on Twitter, there's things I really, really like about Cam. I really, truly do. I think in terms of overall athletic ability, he's easily the best athlete on the line. In terms of aggressiveness of play, again, he's the guy who is going out there and every play, he wants to kill somebody. And I love that. I absolutely freaking love that. And so don't get me wrong. I actually kind of have a soft spot in my heart for the guy because I want to see him on the field somewhere. And part of me, it's, you know, a lot of people are like, well, move him to guard. Get him at right guard. Get Farniok out of there. Which, and I do think Farniok's a liability. I mean, that's a guy you put a half. I mean, you saw what Nixon did to him during the game. I mean, that got ugly after a while.
Davion Nixon's a beast, though. You understand that.
No, and I get that. The guy's a stud, but it's one of those, when you're a fifth-year senior and you're a starter at a program like Nebraska, you expect a higher level of play. And it just, I'm just not seeing that. Now, maybe it's the whole, and, you know, maybe it's the whole Farniok thing. I'm not sure what it is, but for some reason, Power Five programs have had this weird fascination with the Farniaks from Oklahoma to Iowa State to Nebraska. I mean, there's a Farniok that's played for everybody. And truth be told, Matt might be the guy who, in terms of time spent as a starter, might be the best of them. And if that's the case, though, I mean, it's not saying a lot. And like I said, I hate denigrating a guy, but I mean, he's not the strongest player that's played there. I mean, he's just not. And when you look at a guy, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this, and I'm trying to be a little judicial here in my criticism. If it's a guy that would have kicked my butt, I'm going to step back and say, and I don't mean this from a bragging sense, but yeah, if this guy would have kicked my butt, then I'm not going to criticize too much. But I mean, there's a lot of guys I played. I mean, there were NFL Hall of Famers I played against in college. When you look at Sapp and Ray Lewis, and I mean, some of those Oklahoma and Colorado D linemen, you had plenty of longtime NFL guys that I played against the whole time I was in college. And maybe one of the very, very few times I came out of a game going, oh my God, I just got my butt kicked. It was Rusty Medeiros, Orange Bowl after the 91 season. That's really it. And so I have a hard time looking at this and going, okay, is Nixon a beast? Yeah, he is. Would he have schooled me or my brother or Aaron Taylor, Will Shields, Brendan Stye, Joel Wilkes, Ken Malin, Eric Weger, I mean, Jim Scott, any of these other guys that I played with over the years? And I have a lot of trouble thinking, yeah, Nixon feasts on those guys like he did on Farniok. I'm like, yeah, nah, that's not happening. I mean, those guys would have gotten low, gotten the base, and punched him right in the mouth, and it would have been a battle, but they wouldn't have gotten their asses kicked. And that was a dirt road ass kicking. I mean, you walk out of that game and you're like, man, I got my ass handed to me today. I mean, it was, because here's the thing, it was game changing plays on defense.
Yeah.
Those were interior defensive linemen making game changing plays. And there's not a lot. I mean, you've got your Aaron Donalds out there, you got your Warren Sapp's out there, but there's not a lot of Sue's another good example. It's easy to find good examples of game changing interior D linemen, because most of the time their job is to sort of take up space, tie up a couple of blockers, and let a defensive end, a linebacker, or your stud safety come running in and make the play. And when you're seeing those guys, those interior guys, getting into the backfield, making plays, getting sacks, making these game-changing plays, it's a little out of character in terms of how most defenses are designed to work. And again, I agree, Nixon's a freaking beast. That guy's a good ball player. Would I take him on our team? Without a doubt. I mean, don't have to ask me that one twice. I just... we need to be better. And that's, I don't want to say I'm hugely bothered, but it's, I hope we're moving in a direction where you don't see a guy like Farniok getting his butt kicked after this year.
Yeah.
It's hugely disappointing to me. Now, maybe he moves on and ends up having a really solid career after this, goes to the NFL, gets a different set of eyes on him, different coaching, level of coaching, and things change and he develops much more. I'll keep my fingers crossed that he does, because truth be told, that's kind of been the trend we've seen. But it's, yeah, I kind of feel bad singling a guy out. But he did. He kind of got his butt kicked. And when I look across that line, it's like, well, was Ben Hart outstanding? No, but you know what? There's some positives there that if he gets a little bit more aggressiveness and a little bit more kind of this killer attitude, I think he could end up being really, really good. Hymus as a freshman had a higher level of productivity than what we've seen from Ben Hart. But I think Ben Hart's going to be much better. I think Hymus is very okay. I think he's playing right now maybe at a pinch better level than he played it as a freshman. I think Ethan Piper, because he's a better overall athlete and plays like a mean son of a bitch, has a higher ceiling than a lot of these guys. I've got a soft spot for Cam Jurgens for reasons already stated, but I mean, those little things need to get cleaned up. You can't have bad snaps anymore. Anyway, sorry, I kind of tangented here. I'm ranting about the offensive line. You asked about the center position. The big bottom line for me is the fact that I think it should be treated as a specialized position, and I'm not sure Austin and Frost treat it as a specialized position. It's not like you see a guy, like a kid comes in out of high school who's a wide receiver who happens to throw a pretty nice ball and gets moved to quarterback. You never see that happen. Quarterback is a highly specialized position. I mean, literally 99% of college quarterbacks were high school quarterbacks. It's just not a position where you see guys come in and, yeah, you know what, we're going to make you a quarterback. The center, I think, is a hell of a lot more specialized than even a lot of college coaches give a credit for. Now, I understand the concept that if you've got a kid that you think is an exceptional athlete, you want to move them to center. And teams have done that for decades. I mean, you look at them and go like, hey, we need to put our best offensive linemen at center, so we're going to do that, because we need the best guy there. And I think that's what they tried to do with Cam Jurgens, is where they looked at him and said, hey, we're going to make this guy our center because he might be the best blocker we've got.
Don't you have to be a bit cerebral though too? I mean, we talk about guys who they're making calls at the line. You got to be the best, but you also got to be the smartest, don't you?
You got to have an incredible understanding of the offense. You got to know what's happening, basically with everybody on every single play. And so that's the thing that I mean. I think Jurgens, he's a guy that, I mean, if he can remain healthy, which is something I hugely worry about from a foot and ankle standpoint, he's had foot and ankle stuff that's been really well documented going all the way back to high school. If he can get healthy and stay healthy, he's a guy that I think blossoms in the NFL. He's he hits that blossoming like 2 years from now, which is disappointing because he's a guy that if you saw him playing offensive line coming out of high school, I think this transition's hugely easier. It's just, this was a guy who spent his entire redshirt year thinking, I'm going to be a blocking tight end. And never really, you know, or even a pass-catching tight end, I suppose. I mean, he spent that first year, his redshirt year, doing everything he could to keep his weight down around 250 or so he could be a tight end. And I think if he had played offensive line prior to his freshman year at Nebraska, I think it changes a lot. And I think he's far more developed, at least as playing, being an offensive lineman, being a center goes, than he is right now. I still think in terms of him really hitting his stride, I think he's still a year or two away. But when he does hit that, again, a lot of it's going to depend on how healthy he stays. But if he can really hit his stride, he's a guy that I think, honest to God, could be all world. I just worry we're going to maybe get 1 year's worth of that, and then he's going to be on to the next level.
So let's switch gears to the quarterback position now, because Adrian Martinez and Luke McCaffrey split time on Friday against Iowa. I thought both played decent at times, others, and they didn't play that great at times. But, you know, Scott Frost after the game said Luke McCaffrey's the future of the program. So what does this look like going forward? You can't run a platoon system and be as effective on offense as you want to be. So what does this look like?
God, that's going to be tough. I have trouble wrapping my head around what they're planning on doing. I mean, keep in mind, you know, and again, there's so many eligibility questions all across the board with these guys in terms of who comes out and who decides to do what. But I mean, McCaffrey, unless Logan Smothers turns out to be the super stud that's better than both McCaffrey and Martinez, McCaffrey's going to have 2 years as a starter nailed down for sure. I mean, Martinez is a junior this year. Let's say he starts next year. I mean, McCaffrey's still the future. He's still a starter as a junior and senior then if you just follow the current progression and don't bring anybody else into the equation. I don't have a good answer for you. And part of the reason is there's things I saw that I liked out of Martinez. His throws looked a lot more crisp on Saturday than I'd seen in the past. Both guys, unfortunately, I still feel like don't have a great feel in terms of seeing the whole field. I mean, I still feel like they're kind of, there's always a guy wide open that these guys aren't seeing. And a lot of it's on blitz pickup, where if there's a blitz coming, you got to know where the hot guy's at. You got to be able to dump the ball to that guy. And they're just not seeing that right now, which when you go back to, well, I thought they had, I mean, when you look at the head coach, the offensive coordinator, the quarterback guru, you look at that coaching staff, that's the position that you'd think would have this stuff down without a doubt, would be the quarterbacks, and we're just not seeing that. I mean, the blitz pickup is still a problem for these guys. You blitz them, they're either going to run or they're going to run. They're going to get sacked or they're going to dump the ball off to nobody because they don't know. Like I said, they just don't know how to find that hot read where you dump the ball when a blitz is coming. And that's a problem also for both of those guys. I think McCaffrey tends to be a little bit better on the true run pass options where, if it's not there, he just takes off and goes. And I think he does a little bit better with that one aspect of the offense, which also makes him seems like he's the leading rusher most games. But again, we've also talked about the fact that if your quarterback's the leading rusher, that's a problem. Bottom line is that I don't have a great answer as to who should be the starting quarterback, because both these guys have some strengths. They both have some definitive weaknesses. And it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not sure I have a problem with the concept of you give each of these guys a couple of series to start the game, and then you go with whoever's got the hotter hand.
Boy, that'd be tough.
And that's not a great answer, because for all those reasons we talked earlier, different quarterbacks have enough of the different style. You hear cadences different with each quarterback. And I get it, they're clapping, but I do agree that it's probably a little bit different. But both of these guys do things a little bit differently. Receivers react differently. Linemen have to block a little bit differently based upon who's in the game. And it makes it tough on everybody. So that is a far from ideal situation. But I'm not sure I've got a great answer otherwise, because I do think there's things McCaffrey does a little bit better than Martinez. I do think he's a little bit better of a runner in traffic. He breaks tackles better. And I think he does a better job of knowing when to pull that trigger and take off running in the first place. It seems, other than on Saturday, I thought McCaffrey has a little more zip to his passes. Martinez seems to have worked out some kinks in his shoulder with that. At least on Saturday he did. But again, there's other aspects. I mean, play calling still bothers me. Where is the running back run game? Where are throws to the wide receivers? Why is Xavier Betts not getting minimum 5 touches a game? I mean, there's a lot of these things where I look at some of these guys that you want to see so much more of, and I think Nebraska is going to have to do to have some success, and they're just not doing it, and I don't have a good answer why. I'm sure there's a reason why, but I just don't have a good reason why.
Were you surprised to read in the Omaha World Herald after the loss that since the Thanksgiving Day loss or Black Friday loss in 2001 to Colorado, Nebraska's lost 100 games?
That's a lot.
That's a crazy number, man.
It is. I mean, that's basically 5 games a year for 20 years. I mean, that's kind of rough when you think about the history that Nebraska had prior to that. I mean, I saw somebody on social media made the comment that, hey, we need to give Frost time. We gave Tom Osborne 2 decades before he turned the corner. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not sure that's an apples to apples comparison right there. Tom Osborne was for that 20 years, Osborne was at like 9.4 wins a year, was in fact actually picking up a good handful of conference titles, and basically played a couple of national title games prior to quote unquote turning the corner. So that was a pretty gentle turn he had to make. There in the early 90s. It's not like Osborne was trying to develop out of a 5-6 coach or 6-5 coach and all of a sudden was punching out 10 to 12 win seasons. I mean, we're at a point right now, we're just trying to get to a winning season. I mean, you got to think about this a little bit here. I mean, we're in year 3 of Frost. It was Riley's second year. So what would that have been? 2016?
Yes, I believe so.
2016 was the last time Nebraska had a winning season. Wow. I mean, that's brutal. I mean, we're not trying to turn the corner to championships. We're just trying to get to a damn winning season. We're just trying to get to bowl eligibility, for God's sakes. And that's something we just haven't had since 2016. And that 2016 season, I still think, was mostly smoke and mirrors. I mean, there was a number of really close wins that year, And I thought Nebraska got exposed in the last few games of the season.
Well, so, up next is Purdue. Purdue's coming off, what, three straight losses. They've lost to Northwestern 27-20. They lost to Minnesota 34-31. They lost this past weekend to Rutgers 37-30. Up next, Nebraska at Purdue, a team that, well, it's like Nebraska, is going to be pretty damn hungry for a win.
They are, and I think Purdue probably has – I think Brohm's an excellent coach. I think he's a very, very good coach. This is a tough one for me to predict because I think you've got two teams that are very similar. I mean, Purdue's right on the cusp of – I mean, you look at all three of those games, all three of those losses, Purdue had their opportunities to win it. I mean, you look at Northwestern, you look at Iowa – it's easy to look at those two games and say, hey, you know what? Nebraska had their opportunities to win those games. I mean, it's we had our opportunities to lose Penn State also, but it's the opportunities were there for Purdue. This is it's not like you look at Purdue and say, hey, this is a team coming off three straight losses. They're not very good. They're a pretty solid team, and they've got some really good athletes. And if you want recent history, it's not like Scott Frost has beat Purdue the previous 2 years.
True.
So it's this is a tough draw for Nebraska. I mean, nothing's easy going forward here. So
no, it's Purdue left, and then Purdue left, and then Minnesota, right?
You got Minnesota, who, again, I know what Frost did to Minnesota in his first year, but, I mean, last year was just plain ugly. And it's not like Minnesota, on the whole, is a drastically different team, than personnel-wise, at least, than they were the year before. And so I look at Minnesota, and I still think this is a really dangerous animal. Now, you want my prediction? I think if Nebraska can come out and the players can have that same fire that they had against Penn State, the same emotional wherewithal they had against Iowa. If there was one thing I liked about the fact that they showed a lot of fight in some of these games. Indiana, I thought, was a joke of a game. I'm sorry, not Indiana. Illinois was an absolute joke in terms of preparation, coming out there and being willing to play the game of football. But if they come out there with a lot of fire, I think they could do some really, really good things against both Purdue and Minnesota. And I don't want to say salvage a season, but you can at least – you've got a little something to build on going into the off season. I think they still get, what, that crossover game?
Yep.
Kind of yet to be named here. I mean, I got my fingers crossed. I'm hoping to God it's Michigan because I think they're atrocious, but – not like we're exactly much better. So
well, you mentioned the crossover game. I'm going to switch total gears here. You may have a crossover game of Ohio State and Wisconsin because neither the one of those teams may be eligible. Well, we know Wisconsin's not eligible to play in the Big Ten championship game, and if Ohio State misses next week, they're probably out of the Big Ten championship game. Big Ten's weird, man, and this is what happens when you don't build time in to make games up.
Well, it's not like this hasn't been a criticism we've discussed going all the way back to August. To not see this coming shows a massive level of incompetence within the leadership of the Big Ten Conference, at least as it pertains to athletics. The thing is, however, I think they totally saw this coming. They're just okay with it. That I think this was the reason. It was sort of one of those, fine, you're not going to let us cancel the season. We're going to essentially cancel it by proxy by having the season start at Halloween. That way we're going to get hammered with COVID running into November and essentially have to cancel the latter half of the season that we as the Big Ten leadership didn't want to have in the first place. That's what I think they did. I mean, I think this was by design.
So do you think Ohio State still makes the college football playoff, even if it doesn't play in the Big Ten championship game? Because I do.
It depends on how many total games they get in. I'll be curious to see what happens. I think the committee is going to look at it's still going to look at Ohio State and go, okay, you know what, they're probably still in that top four from a purely talent standpoint. I mean, do you think A&M's that much better? Do
No.
you think Florida's that much
No.
better? Do you think Georgia's that much better?
Hell,
that you put any of those teams
in
there? I think
right now you'd have to look at Cincinnati and BYU. Right, I mean that would be,
and I don't think anybody looks at those
no.
two teams and says, yeah, they're better than Ohio State. And there is going to be a little bit of some question here because you got Clemson, you got Alabama. We're kind of assuming they're in.
Notre Dame.
You got Notre Dame, and then I think you have Ohio State. I think that's your four.
And then after that is A&M, which was blown out by Alabama. Florida. At 6-1, Cincinnati at 8-0. Northwestern's going to drop now because it got beat. Georgia's at 5-2.
Michigan, Spartans, baby.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see anybody. You know who you could put in there, but it won't happen. Iowa State's playing really good football right now, but Iowa State, because it lost to Louisiana to start the season off, it screwed itself.
Well, they've got they lost to Oklahoma State as well, too. I mean, you've got a team with two losses.
Yeah, well, that's
and
true.
In this season, you know, even as well as Iowa State's playing right now, in this season that's already been shortened up, those two losses, that's an automatic out.
I don't disagree with you, but I'm just looking at Ohio State. Let's say Ohio State doesn't play this weekend. Plays, then it would play, you know, one more game after that, and possibly, well, let's say you had Wisconsin, they could be 6-0. Is 6-0 going to be good enough to put you in the college football playoff? I don't know the answer to that, but
if all six of those wins are really solid, good looking wins, then yeah, I think they do.
Yeah, I mean, it's
good, but it's not like you look. But it's not like you look at Wisconsin and that's a glowing win on your resume.
No, no. And
it's not an undefeated Wisconsin team.
But I'm not going to put Miami up there, right? Miami's ranked 10th right now in the college football playoff poll.
I think Ohio State definitely gets a fair amount of deference from the committee based on what they've done in the past. The talent they had coming into this season. And you know what is a big – you know what? I am a little bit of a Big Ten fan. I mean, it's – like I said, I've always been a closet Michigan State guy. If Ohio State goes 6-0 or maybe sneaks in one more game here and goes 7-0. But even at 6-0, I would take them. I would still say I'd have a hard time pulling them out of the top four. I mean, if they've been in the top four up until this point, do you penalize them merely for not playing a game?
That's
especially when it's games that they probably were going to win anyway. I shouldn't say that, but you look at, I mean, right now they're kind of one of their glowing wins is the Indiana game.
Yeah.
I mean, if Indiana keeps doing what they've been doing, I wholeheartedly expect to see Indiana. I think Indiana finishes number two in the East to Ohio State.
Well, and it could be Indiana Northwestern then for the Big Ten championship game if Ohio State doesn't play this weekend. I mean, Ryan Day's got COVID. Their numbers started going up. The league didn't cancel them out. Ohio State canceled itself.
Yeah,
no,
they pulled themselves
yeah,
out.
Because
I have trouble thinking they don't play next week.
I'm though. With you.
I think they figure out a way to quarantine enough guys, and I think they get a plan together to put X number of contact traced guys out onto the field to play the game.
I'm with you.
And you know what? If you, and again, I mean, if you can get I mean, I'm not sure who all the players are, but I mean, if you can get Justin Fields, if you can get Teague, if you can get two of their top four wide receivers out onto the field, they're going to knock out a win, I think.
I would not disagree with you, and I think they will do everything they can to get a game in, because I know they want to play for a national championship. They think they're that good. So it'll be interesting to see how the Big Ten unfolds with two weeks left in the season, and we got the crossover game coming up, which will be very, very interesting. Dr. Rob, it's always a pleasure. I'm sorry we're still separated by social distancing, but sooner or later we'll get you back in the studio. I know our good friend Steve Swanstrom has some new Glarus, a brand new batch of new Glarus coming in for us.
It's kind of sad when all you got to do is say Steve's name and the first thought that pops in my head is like, ooh, new Glarus.
Yes, but don't forget, I still have all those sours that we haven't even touched yet, too. And there's a new Glarus cherry tart in there as well.
That is true. I like Steve in studio because he's fun. He's a fun guy to have in studio just because it's diehard Husker fan. I love him to death for that reason alone.
But you know where he went to college, right? You know where he went to college.
I know.
He's an Iowa grad.
Hey, you can't help where you're from.
Oh,
but
man.
I like the fact that few guys have better in-studio reaction to the stuff we're saying than Steve does.
That's so true. If you haven't followed Dr. Rob on Twitter, please do so at Doc Talk Sports. Again, that's at Doc Talk Sports. If you like the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy, please give us a rating on iTunes or Stitcher or iHeart or Spotify or wherever you happen to listen to this podcast. And if you have extra time, go ahead and give us a review because, well, reviews just help us get found, and we like it when people give us reviews, good, bad, or indifferent. Your reviews also help get the word out about the Husker Doc Talk podcast. You know, it's been a weird year. COVID has restricted a lot of things. We still want you to take care and patronize our sponsors when you can. Ticket Express. Don't forget, you can get 2021 Husker season tickets for your stocking stuffers this Christmas. If you're looking for Nebraska gear, visit Scotty at Husker Hounds. He's got a plethora of stuff for you to pick from and three stores in the Omaha area. And, of course, when you got to drink beer this holiday season, drink responsibly, but drink Infusion Brewing Company beer. Dr. Rob, it's always my pleasure to talk to you, and let's catch up again next week, all right?
Absolutely. Wear a mask, sign a center.
It's the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy. We'll see you next week.